position number 12385, rule 10.
Yes. Then we got on this, and then when we got to Kenora, on these series of lakes there, right on the United States border, the government said the mounted police, we saw them lined up with several machine guns, and they said, whatever happens, you're not going ahead. And I was one of the few people, I said, well, one, I don't think they would dare to shoot, and even if they did shoot, it would bring down the government, such a massacre of unarmed people. But they didn't take my advice, and I think only one other person supported me. So that, again, we said, oh, we'd call it off. And from there, they took the... implement their giving us passes, and I took my pass to go to Halifax, and the others passes wherever they wanted to go in Canada, some to Vancouver, some back to the camps and so on. But eventually the next year, which I wasn't in Canada to see, it had, they did say that this, they were going to destroy Bennett. And this relief camp march did destroy him. It was the Conservative government, and the Liberal government took over after that. By this time I was in Spain. So
how did you come to go to Spain then, Phil? After this experience. Yes.
Then I went back to Halifax. I decided there wasn't any future there because, and I still had this yen of trying to get to the Soviet Union, you see. So I thought, well, I'll get a job. And I signed on a Norwegian vessel, the Wagland, and after a bit of a lousy trip across the Atlantic, landed in England, and I then tried to for quite a while to get a ship to the Soviet Union, but I was unsuccessful.
Why was that? Why were you unsuccessful?
Well, you know, they're not all that number going there, and even if there are they're not taking on people just ad lib. It's only if someone's sick or injured or something like that you can get a chance there. But after hanging around in London for a while, but then I started reading more and more in the daily press and the paper about things. After the Popular Front government victory in Spain, the fascists weren't accepting that, and they were murdering people whenever they got the chance, because they were they had a mixed government in power there. The Popular Front had about 60% of the seats, but the other 40% were held by extreme right wingers or centrist parties. The communists only had, they had about 10 members of parliament, I think, but none in the government, of course. I remember reading that. Someone had, one of the leading left-wing people had been shot, one of the leaders of the Carabineros, and they had been shot, taken out, shot by these fascists. And then in retaliation, the left-wing people took one of the leading members of parliament, a fascist, I've forgotten his name, I've got the names almost, and they took him out and took him to a cemetery and shot him in retaliation. That was happening all the time. So, and then when I was, I joined the Communist Party in Finchley there, and then a lady, Joan Beecham, I think, and she was married to a King's Counselor or something there. She was a communist, and her husband was in the Labour Party. And she'd just come back from Spain, and she was recounting how that when she was in Spain, on every street corner she saw young fellows and young girls with red armbands, and just in ordinary clothes and red armbands, carrying hunting rifles or shotguns and so on, and guarding each corner and railway station and so on. And I felt all this was, you know, something rather like at the beginning of the Weimar Republic with the fascists starting in Germany. And I thought, well, this has given me a chance to trade on my photographic experience, although I was a very poor photographer at that time. But I thought at least it would be instrumental in getting me experience and so on. Of course, I couldn't foretell that a war was going to break out. Just that I thought general street fights and all this, and I wanted to be in, have some of the action. So then I knew it would be difficult getting over to Spain. So I then, knowing that there were ships on strike because they weren't getting, although they'd got a popular front government, and they brought in new laws increasing the wages of seamen and so on, it still wasn't being implemented by the bosses, that they were on strike in Cardiff. So I made my way down there, and with a little bit of experience that I had, a few words of Spanish that I'd learned when I'd been in Mexico for a short period, I said to the strike leader, he was in the National Union of Seamen's headquarters, the British National Union of Seamen's, because they used that as the headquarters for the strike committee. And most of the officers were in sympathy with the men anyway on the ship, so that, with a sort of little bit of broken English from the boatswain of this ship, he was also the head of the strike committee of all these, the ships that were on strike. And he said, he didn't know about the rest of the ships. He thought they'd very soon be leaving for Spain. But the ship that he was on was leaving almost right away. I think he said, as soon as she's loaded later on today, we'll be leaving tonight. I said, is it possible? Do you think if I stow away? He said, yes, unofficially, I can't give you any help. But I'll pass the word amongst the crew to close their eyes if they see anything. So I made my way there, down there, and I saw the longshoreman putting the last touches on the ship, battening down the hatches. And also it had been cold. Of course, most ships were coal burners at that time. And I went down down the fiddly way right to the bottom of the ship there, where I saw four guys playing cards with in a very sort of dim light, and they sort of looked up in surprise when I came down. I gave a clenched fist salute and said, "Watch a pay, camarada, poor Spaniard," and just in a few words, and they sort of grinned, and then I sort of said the word in Spanish for coal bunker, and they just pointed that way, and I went to the in amongst the coal and buried myself in the coal, and then pulled my my Mackinaw coat over my head, and then I did see some flashing lights there. They didn't come right where I was close, but they did shine it in there. I don't know who it was, whether it was the British Customs or what have you, but when I reckon we were well out to sea, clear of the Bristol Channel, I came out, a beautiful day, and they took me to the captain, and he was, of course, I was all over covered in coal dust and so on. So, but unlike most captains that, you know, when I explained that I wanted to come and help the Spanish people, he seemed very, very pleased, and his officers, they laughed a bit, and they showed me to the sort of washroom, a sort of primitive washroom where you heat the water with a steam pipe and buckets of water, and then I washed up, and then I didn't know where the ship was going, the captain didn't say, and I don't think the fellow, the bosun, who I spoke to knew himself, but we were headed for Bilbao, because, and by this time the revolt had broken out in Ceuta in northern Africa. So,
Bill, how much kit did you have with you?
Pardon?
How much kit did you have with you at this time?
How much what?
Kit.
Kit. Mm. Oh, yes. At this time, I had just the usual sort of razor and a towel and I don't think I bothered about soap or anything. That, but I did have a couple of small cameras with me, and some film also.
Well, what were these 35mm cameras?
No, I think they were sort of 2x120 sort of thing, so that you were getting an oblong picture, that they were folding cameras, but it wasn't a Leica or anything like that. Of course, the Leica had only just come on the market at that time. So I don't know how long. I suppose about a day later we sailed up the river. I've forgotten the name of the river at Bilbao. It's no good trying to remember. It's on the tip of my tongue. But I did notice that it was either a Saturday or Sunday. I've got a feeling it was the Sunday, and everywhere there was, you could see, oh, first of all, when we came in sight of Spain, I thought, well, this is sunny Spain, is it? It's, it was worse than when we left in South Wales. Overcast, drizzling, dull clouds and everything like that. And a very rocky cliffs and so on, a sort of dismal outlook. And I thought, well, is this sunny Spain sort of thing? But then, of course, a little bit later on, the sun broke through. And then when we were sailing up the river to the outer harbour of Bilbao, which is Portugalete, and they've a long mole coming out into the sea, very much the same as the thing in the battleship Potemkin. And all the people were crowding down on this because there hadn't been any Spanish ships arriving for about a month or so on. And the skipper broke out one of the biggest Spanish Republican flags that I've ever seen. And a great cheer went up from the from the shore, you could hear it from that, and the people were, and the skipper had apparently heard it then. He said, oh, well, on the radio, he said, well, you know, they've revolted in North Africa and so on, and but he hadn't any more details. But when we got to Portugalete, he handed me over to the, you know, normally there'd be a lot of red tape and all this sort of thing, a stowaway landing in a strange country, but no one seemed to bother or anything, and there's a feeling of fiesta in the air, and they all just said of okay, that oh well, and apparently they'd tried a revolt in Bilbao, and it had been quickly squashed because the mass of the soldiers and so on had come out for the Republic, and all the rest of the people. And this was on July 18th, the very day that the war had broken out. And
so you'd arrived on July the 18th.
Pardon?
You'd arrived on July,
on
the,
July 18th, the 18th.
1936.
So that, and then they took me ashore. Didn't allow me to go free or anything, but I think they released me into the custody of a Communist Party official or something like that. And he took me to the, I think it's the Alcada or something like that. It's the City Hall. And in the City Hall was the Basque flag and the Spanish Republican flag and red flag, the anarchist flags and the Communist flag and the flag of the Hovin Communisters, which was the United Communists and Socialists thing. And I looked down into the square by this time. It must have been about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And all the girls were all dancing in their summer dresses, and many of them with the summer dresses on, with a rifle over their shoulders and a red band around their left arm. And they were still dancing away. And I thought, well, it was almost sacrilege in a way, because they were dancing to the strains of the Internationale. And not only that, but the Himno Riego, the Spanish Republican anthem, which they sort of treated like a jig almost, and all the other Spanish songs that I came to know afterwards, all dancing to this thing, and the great mass, old people, young people, and above everything else that I remembered, cars and trucks and everything chasing through the streets with their headlights on in bright daylight, and the sirens going and the claxons sounding, and all the time, you know, you had this terrific hullabaloo. It's almost as a, it was the Russian Revolution happening all over again. But and then they took me to a wonderful palace there, a marble palace, and they said, well, you must be tired, and so on. It was a committee room with a whole lot of all these gilt chairs and a huge bed, a four-poster bed with silk covers and everything. They said, well, you can sleep there. And all the rest were going on. And the rest, just like a Russian film, with all the rifles being put into sort of tripods. Do you know what I mean there? With people with bandoliers, and the girls with bandoliers, girls in 4-inch high heel shoes, and still with a rifle and a smart dress and so on. And the next day they took me to Bilbao, and I joined the militia there, that and we went off to finish the completion of the liberation of San Sebastian. The people had taken over the town already, but it was held by four strong points. I think three big hotels were held by fascists and the fascist soldiery, and also the headquarters in San Sebastian. And although I didn't see it, they said that they used Republican people they'd captured, put those in the windows, and they were firing over them to, and then we had some street fighting, I think, for one or two days, and then we took San Sebastian, but it was completely taken within a couple of days.
Well, what were you doing in the street fighting? Can you remember what did you do?
Oh, when they first of all took me to the headquarters in Bilbao, they took me to a place. It was a sort. I think it was a sort of whether it was a government place or not. Of course, the government in the Basque provinces came out for the Republic. You see. Then down below there was a cellar place, quite a bit of some sandbags, and they wanted to know if I could shoot, and I said, well, that's one thing I can do, and they tested me out with a rifle, and they saw that, of course, most of the militia guys hadn't held a rifle before, and they at once gave me a sort of trusted Mauser, whereas the others so often had shotguns. So in the street fighting in San Sebastian, I was fighting, and that's where I met up with this girl that we had an association with for the rest of the 4 months of her life, Dolores, and she was very, very good, fanatically brave, and so on, and so that. In the street fighting, we were. It wasn't like the fighting that was to come later. You were sort of dodging round behind buildings and under cover, taking shots, and then also we were using these homemade dynamite things. They had dynamiteros, they call them. They made hand grenades out of. Empty cans, different type, and they stuffed that with dynamite and then put a fuse in it, and then you lit it from your cigarette and threw it. But there was the danger, of course, it'd go off before it. I was very chary about those, but all these sort of makeshift things to start with, and we flushed the fascists out of their stronghold. We lost a few, I suppose, about 50 killed and wounded.
How many of you were involved in the action?
Pardon?
How many of you were involved in the action?
Oh, I would say the column, the communist column that went there, was about 500. But then there were others. There were anarchists, battalions, there were sort of formed on the spur of the moment almost, anarchists and then Republican ones and Basque nationalists, and all fighting under their different flags.
So there was no central command?
Oh, there would be a general central command, yes, from the something that wouldn't reach me, of course, but there would be a central command, but a very loose central command, because and the anarchists especially were very keen to prove that they were more valiant than anyone else, and we often wouldn't heed to the commands, but we were highly disciplined there. And to start with, they called the Kolumna that started off the Kolumna Stalin. And I was very, very mortified when 2 days later they changed the name to the Kolumna Miabi. I just couldn't understand that. But perhaps someone at the top thought it wasn't a good idea at all to have a name. Of course, Stalin was looked up to by every left-wing person, not only communists at that time, of course. He was the only bulwark against fascism by this time, and that and so many communists had died heroically in Germany and so on.
Could you describe a bit more about that day, what the fighting? You said you were running around. Could you describe a bit more how the fighting took place?
You were crawling in the gutters, firing round behind any sort of thing that you could get, or then going into a house and then where the fascists and firing from the top floor windows to the fascists. That we had a couple of machine guns, but you could hear them being used, but the fascists had many more. And it was sort of sneaking from one position to another. And that is where the first time I realized that you're going to be very... Because the first time you were going to see some action, the temporary sergeant or the section leader, whoever it was, dished out wholesale lots of very strong Spanish brandy. And it made you feel very wonderful and carefree. But I noticed straight away that my reactions were being slowed up considerably, that I never got drunk. I don't think I've ever been drunk and never known what's happened, whatever, however much I've drunk. But this time I was quite clear about it and quite clear what should be done. But you were just slow in doing it. And I thought this is the best way to get my goddamn head knocked off, you see, so that when it wore off, from that day to the last, over 2 years later, I never had any drink before going into a battle, because I felt that it slowed your reactions. It might not make you drunk, but it would make you a little bit more slap happy and so on. But it's just a question of utilizing every sort of thing, every sort of tree in the park that was round the buildings, automobiles that had been disabled. You were firing from behind those, and also, we had some bullock wagons which we'd pushed up, without the bullocks, of course, there, but these very strong things we'd like that. And I think at one time, I remember, they loaded one of them with hay and pushed it into the, set it alight and pushed it into the hotel entrance where the rest of the people was. And as I said, this fighting continued with... it's very hard to say everything that you... But you very soon begin to realize you take every bit of cover. You see where the firing is coming from and you keep your heads down that and...
Did you shoot anyone, Bill? Do you know or not?
Pardon?
Did you shoot anyone? Do you know or not?
I wouldn't know at that time whether I... later on, I knew, of course, that... But at that time, it was a distance, and I think within 1 or 2 days, the fascists just gave up. And by this time, many of the soldiers that were... there had been coming over to our side anyway, so that that it was just I suppose you'd say it was just a small skirmish in a way.
Had it started off mainly civilians then?
Pardon?
Was the column mainly made up of civilians?
All civilians, yes. Oh, yes.
And at what stage had the soldiers, regular soldiers, begun to join you?
Oh, yes. Straight away, almost. When I say it was almost all civilians, there would be perhaps in our columna that started off from Bilbao, there were about three young soldiers already in the force that joined the column. And I don't know whether, it's, of course, they were communists or what have you. And in the course of the fighting, the last place to hold out, I think, was the headquarters, the military headquarters. And there it was rather difficult for the soldiers to get come over to us. But from the hotels that they'd fortified, two or three of them there, that soldiers did drift over in the that first night, I think.
How did that happen? Were you there when that... Did you see that happen?
Oh, yes. The soldiers would come over and they'd say, camarada, you know, that it's son hermanos proletarios, union hermanos proletarios. That was the sort of password at that time, that union of humanitarian brothers or something. That and wasn't a great many, but I suppose about... well, it's hard to say in our section, about 20 or 30, maybe.
You were saying before that the anarchists were quite foolhardy, or tend to do things their own way. Could you describe an action that you saw that would exemplify that? Do you remember that happening?
Not